Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW, Santa Monica, welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Lydia Davis. Her new book is Samuel Johnson is Indignant, a book of stories from McSweeney's Press. Lydia Davis has been perfecting a certain kind of fiction about which you will hear in earlier books. I started reading her with her very first, The 13th Woman and Other Stories. There was a small book called Sketches for a Life of Vasily that got included in a later book. The story and other stories, the books that we can get, Break It Down, Almost No Memory, her novel, The End of the Story, and now Samuel Johnson is Indignant. Now, I wanted to ask how it was that you came to the short form.
Which short form? Do you mean paragraph form or the...
Well, it's gone from very short stories to begin with, and even early on, one sensed the brevity of the work, even when a piece was, say, an outlandish 17 pages. There was a sense of huge compression. And even in here, there's an early story in the North Country that feels like a condensation of a vast Russian novel. Why the miniaturization?
Gee, that's a tough one. I know I started out trying to write conventional short stories, and I had a very clear idea how long they should be. Both my parents were story writers and actually had stories in The New Yorker. So my ambition from a very early age, I didn't even question it, was to be a writer and to have a story in The New Yorker. That was pinnacle. That was what you wanted to do. And I didn't know any other truth to writing. That was the form. And that was what I worked on in college, and that's... even though I knew about the stories of Kafka that were all sizes also, from the very long to shorter, and down to one paragraph, a short paragraph. But that seemed to be something that only Kafka could do. He was Kafka, and that's what he did. It wasn't available to all of us, you know. And then it was Russell Edson, who I read him in, say, 1971 or something. What encouraged me to try the short form was that Edson didn't always succeed in these stories. Some of them were wonderful and very moving, and others were too silly and, you know, didn't work. And so there was sort of like a grade B movie where you can, it shows you how a movie is made because you can see the places where it fails. And also his subjects were so outlandish and so from some deep psychic space that most of us don't want to touch, you know, family stuff, crude, difficult family stuff.
Very primal. Very violent. Mm-hmm. Everyone is always yelling, and the yelling gets louder and louder through the stories.
Yeah, so I think, so as to why I was drawn to short, you know, that's much harder to say. Because if I only did short things, you could say, well, I'm a person who only wants to say a little bit about anything. Maybe I'm inhibited, maybe I'm shy. But the truth is I like to write very long things, too. So it's, you know, it's more puzzling than that. I think I try to think that each piece reacts to the subject matter so that if there's a great deal to say, I say a great deal. If there's a thought that's very limited and circumscribed, I say just a little bit.
Now, I know that one of your influences was Samuel Beckett, and we've spoken about that before. But one of the things that I notice about writers who read Beckett is that they develop an extraordinary ear for the length of syllables, for long vowels and short vowels. Since Beckett has removed so much, the ear for what remains becomes almost eerily precise. And I sense in your work an almost inhuman perfectionism, you know, combing it through again and again. And I wonder, what is it that you are most sensitive to in your own prose?
Well, taking away excess, I'm sure. You know, the one repetition that is one too many, the sentence that's one too many. I keep thinking of the Beckett, you know, that something about the steps that dint by dint her little steps had trod or something. I used to copy little bits of Beckett sentences and put them up on the bulletin board and look at them and repeat them and learn them. Excess and dullness sometimes. You can take out something that's too commonplace, too expected. I guess the compression, say, of Grace Paley, where, you know, everything is jammed into one sentence. Something I can't quote exactly because I heard her read it, but she was quoting a woman she had met in prison who said something like, "My father, who God rest his soul, is, thank God, dead." You know, so sort of combining, you know, three contradictory emotions in about six words. You know, that I love. You know,
we're in the library at the Lannan Foundation Santa Fe, and so the interview has the benefit of an enthusiastic but small audience. Now, you said dullness. Now, certainly we mean something very unusual by this dullness, because Samuel Beckett, for instance, loves a certain kind of dullness. And one can't even say the commonplace, because Beckett loves finding the perfect commonplace. And I know in talking to Dave Eggers, who edited Samuel Johnson Is Indignant by my guest Lydia Davis, you had in an exchange of letters told him that everything was acceptable except standard English. And I have the feeling that that's what we're talking about in some way.
Well, I love non-standard English. I don't know if I said exactly everything is acceptable but standard English, because in a way I write very standard English, and it's almost frightening that I can't deal easily with slang, I can't deal easily with casual writing. I tried to write a story all in slang. Let's see, it's called The Meeting. But to do this, I mean, not all in slang, but I wanted it to be full of slang. But to do it, I had to go to a slang dictionary. And I actually used very outdated slang.
Well, let's hear The Meeting. We didn't plan on it, but let's give it a whirl.
Well, okay. The Meeting. I tried so hard. The clothes I wore, new look I had, I thought. Competent, I thought. Casual, new raincoat, brown. Things seemed all right at first, promising, in the waiting room. Top secretary offered me the comfortable chair, a cup of tea. Top secretary or second secretary. Declined the tea. How could I swallow it? How could I even hold the cup? Opened my little book. Thought once I got in there, he might even ask me what I was reading. Wait, he might say, is that Addison? Kept my head down, eyes on the page, listened to the secretaries, thought I was learning the inside dope. Feeling smart, thought I was all buttoned up. Yes, and now here we were alone for the first time at last, and I thought we might have a special rapport. He might become a friend, at least. I thought he might say to himself, here is this woman, this attractive woman. I've talked to her before, never at length, unfortunately. Now she's here across my desk from me in an attractive raincoat with some jewelry on. I thought he might say, she's quiet, but I know from what I've heard and from the way she sits there so composed, holding this small book bound in green leather, could it be Addison? that she's intelligent, though obviously shy. It will be interesting to talk to her. Here he is, the boss, and there are no distractions. There's no one coming into the room, no one offering something from a tray, no one walking past, no one drinking next to him, no one asking him a sudden question that left me out rudely, no one standing in a circle with him. Here we are alone, my face floating over that piled desk. But he rails against the whole project. He uses bad language, though it isn't my fault. It really isn't my fault. What he doesn't like, the change of title. And in fact, he's wrong about that. Things have to change. Even titles have to change. How he jumps on me. How he strafes me. How he slangs me. I'm rocked. Of course, anyone can make an appointment to see the president. That's the easy part. I try again, surface and take another breath. Say something. He stops railing and listens. He says something back, asks me a decent question. But I can't remember that name. I just can't remember it. Me with my shaky voice. Now what can I say? Don't have a single million-dollar word. Say something dumb. Now he's doing his best. He's trying to remember his manners. But after that, all that yelling, he says he isn't the one who can help me. No, even though they said I should go and talk to him myself. They both said that. And they know him. I thought I could trust them. Just plant the idea in his head, at least, they said. I guess maybe they sold me a pup. What a blunder. And I wore all this jewelry, every piece I had that was decent. He never noticed, I'm sure. No, he just said to himself, not my concern, sorry. Wait, I thought, give me time, another 5 minutes. But it's no use. Now he stands up and sticks his hand across the desk at an angle and flat as a piece of cardboard. He's offering to shake. It's his signal. I'm supposed to leave. Well, lost opportunity, Mr. President, old bean. We're not all so clever, you know. Not on the spot like that, beanpole. Someday you'll make me an offer. I'll say I can't help you. Such a mistake even to go in there. So wrong. Some other frequency. Can't do anything right. Not worth shucks. Strange hat, brown coat, drooping hem, bare neck, yellow skin, wrong jewelry, too much jewelry. So many mistakes. Electric hair. So many mistakes. Too much, too little, wrong time, wrong place, can't do it right. Do it anyway, spoil it, do it again, spoil it again. A slime, a weed. I wanted respect. Did he even see me? Did he even see my head poking up above those piles? He was seeing another appointment. This was my appointment. Maybe the raincoat gave a bad impression. Maybe I was wrong to wear brown. Maybe he thought, uh-oh, there's something depressing out there in the waiting room. Brown woman with a proposal sitting in a chair with her book. And then I wasn't prepared, didn't know the name. I nodded. Anyone can nod. I didn't know what was coming. I was so dumb. I'm aching. What shame. Ready to kill. Wish I'd had my mother with me. She would have said something. A gas bag. He would have said she was a gabby old woman, an ulcer. What's she doing in here? Who let her in? Get her out of here. In her pastel suit. But there she'd be. She'd account for him. She'd give it to him right in the clock. He'd say, get the old bag off my dark wood paneling. That's my mother. What a Barney. Hoo-ha. She'd give him a mouse all right. He'd say, get the old bag in her pink suit away from in front of my dark wood paneling. Get him, mother. Sick him. Old Iowa bag. Come in here with her replaced hip, her replaced knee, one leg shorter than the other, built-up shoe, determined. She'd lam him in his little Mary, quick and smart. She'd have the edge on him. What's this, he would have said. Kick this old lady out of here in her spring suit. He might have used bad language about her, too. Kick this old fart out of here. Maybe I should have taken my whole family in there with me. Brother watching, father watching, sister getting up to help, but mother's the one who would floor him. Mother would thrash him. She'd baste his jacket. She's high rent. She would have said, be nice to her. He wasn't nice to me. That's my daughter. He wasn't nice. She would have given him a piece of her fist. See this? Shaking it right in his pan. names for him. She doesn't come as a water carrier for anyone. Annihilate him, mother. Crush him. No more, bam, president of this place. New president, please. Better one, please. Oh, boy, sock. You'll see, Mr. President. Summer complaint. Dog's breakfast.
Lydia Davis, reading the meeting from her collection, Samuel Johnson, is indignant. Wow. Now, that's what I call an ecstasy of self-consciousness, which seems to be one of the things that you specialize in. Not exactly ecstasy, but the pleasure of mountainous, droning concern for the details that the imagination produces to its own indignation. And is indignation a starting point for you?
Well, actually, indignation is a big part of my psychic makeup. I'm indignant about a great many things a great deal of the time. And the people around me who have to live with me have to stop me from talking about all the things I'm indignant about. So it's in a way, you know, not only Samuel Johnson is indignant, but I'm indignant.
And indignant that Samuel Johnson is indignant, indignant at his indignation.
Oh, no, no, I sympathize with his indignation.
Compassionate with indignation.
That's right.
Because it does seem as if these pieces come from an essentially fair-minded person who wishes that this tendency toward caviling would not constantly assert itself. There's almost a reprimanding that goes on in some of the pieces where the narrator feels compelled to almost comfort herself. I didn't interrupt just then. I didn't say I was right when I was wrong. I didn't say I was right when I was right. There's a kind of constantly self-trumping id voice? Is that what it's called?
Well, I guess it's a constant dialogue, you know. I guess, yeah, it's the ultimate self-consciousness, which can be frightening when taken to an extreme. You know, I'm conscious of myself thinking this and then thinking that I'm conscious that I'm thinking it, and it goes to a terrifying extreme where you can't make a move without sort of reflecting it in, you know, in a dozen mirrors.
This is Lydia Davis.
And this is called Letter to a Funeral Parlor. Dear Sir, I am writing to you to object to the word cremains, which was used by your representative when he met with my mother and me 2 days after my father's death. We had no objection to your representative personally, who was respectful and friendly and dealt with us in a sensitive way. He did not try to sell us an expensive urn, for instance. What startled and disturbed us was the word cremains. You in the business must have invented this word, and you are used to it. We, the public, do not hear it very often. We don't lose a close friend or a family member very many times in our life, and years pass in between, if we are lucky. Even less often do we have to discuss what is to be done with a family member or close friend after their death. We noticed that before the death of my father, you and your representative used the words loved one to refer to him. This was comfortable for us, even if the ways in which we loved him were complicated. Then we were sitting there in our chairs in the living room, trying not to weep in front of your representative, who was opposite us on the sofa. And we were very tired, first from sitting up with my father, and then from worrying about whether he was comfortable as he was dying, and then from worrying about where he might be now that he was dead. And your representative referred to him as the cremains. At first, we did not even know what he meant. Then, when we realized, we were frankly upset. Cremains sounds like something invented as a milk substitute in coffee, like Cremora or Coffee Mate. Or it sounds like some kind of a chipped beef dish. As one who works with words for a living, I must say that any invented word like porta potty or pooper scooper has a cheerful or even jovial ring to it that I don't think you really intended when you invented the word cremains. In fact, my father himself, who was a professor of English and is now being called the cremains, would have pointed out to you the alliteration in porta potty and the rhyme in pooper scooper Then he would have told you that cremains falls into the same category as brunch and is known as a portmanteau word. There is nothing wrong with inventing words, especially in a business, but a grieving family is not prepared for this one. We are not even used to our loved one being gone. You could very well continue to employ the term ashes. We are used to it from the Bible and are even comforted by it. We would not misunderstand. We would know that these ashes are not like the ashes in a fireplace. Yours sincerely.
Lydia Davis. Oh, my. Now, there's something to me that is both simply and complicatedly heartbreaking about this. It's not only about the modern world that invents words like cremains. It's that this woman has put on hold her feelings about the death of her father in order to complain about the word cremains. And so we're experiencing the heartbreak at a second remove.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if what we're saying is, how can she have the presence of mind to be complaining about cremains when her father has died?
And yet you see that humanly so often.
Yes,
someone who is in an agony over one serious thing will get terribly upset by where she's sitting in the air conditioning and, you know, something completely small.
Right, so it feels like the story says that the human condition is to complain about something small, although unbearable, when something large and more unbearable is at stake. And you feel too human when you read this. Do you know what I mean? It made me feel gasping with my need to delay loss.
And yet you can think of it as not such a small thing when you think, you know, what are you calling my father? You know,
yes.
He's never been called that, and who are you to call him that? You know, names, you know, he was always the professor, or, you know, professor.
Yes. This is the era of names that will harm me. You know, they enter the sticks and stones materialization phase. Now, this brings me to what I consider to be some of the most exciting Lydia Davis, which is the Davis that has become so passionate about language that it's beginning to infect her imagination. And it takes on a kind of life of its own. I'm talking, of course, about my favorite piece in the new book, Samuel Johnson is Indignant, which is called A Mown Lawn. And I just think it's extraordinary. For me, listening to it and reading it, it's like the fun that I have in what I think of as the most fun conversation about language in all literature, the one that Alice has with Humpty Dumpty, in which, by the way, he tells her what a portmanteau word is. And
oh. Good.
He invented the portmanteau word, as far as I understand it.
I don't know, yeah.
But this is Lydia Davis reading A Mown Lawn.
A Mown Lawn. She hated a mown lawn. Maybe that was because mow was the reverse of wum, the beginning of the name of what she was, a woman. A mown lawn had a sad sound to it, like a long moan. From her, a mown lawn made a long moan. Lawn had some of the letters of man, though the reverse of man would be nam, a bad war, a raw war. Lawn also contained the letters of law. In fact, lawn was a contraction of lawman. Certainly a lawman could and did mow a lawn. Law and order could be seen as starting from lawn order, valued by so many Americans. More lawn could be made using a lawnmower. A lawnmower did make more lawn. More lawn was a contraction of more lawmen. Did more lawn in America make more lawmen in America? Did more lawn make more nam? More mown lawn made more long moan from her. Or a lawn mourn. So often, she said, Americans wanted more mown lawn. all of America might be one long mown lawn. A lawn not mown grows long, she said. Better a long lawn. Better a long lawn and a mole. Let the lawman have the mown lawn, she said. Or the moron, the lawn moron.
You know, Lydia, I don't think I know of another piece, in fact, where something that could be looked at as a series of puns becomes sadder and sadder and sadder. You know, it's almost as if the wordplay here is to lead the speaker and then us into a befuddlement of sadness.
Yeah, I was asked by a freshman. I was addressing 150 freshmen, and I was told that half of them liked the book, which was considered a terrific percentage of a group of 150 freshmen. But they were very critical, too, and very direct. And one of them said, why did you do this in this story? What's the point of all this wordplay and so on? And so I was forced to answer, you know, I'm not forced to think about it ahead of time, and I'm, you know, often not forced to think about it after the fact either. But I began to see that wordplay as frustration, that and it is born of frustration. I can't affect these mown lawns. I can't affect what America does with its lawns and how it treats its nature and what would live in the long, unmown grass. I can't affect that. I have no effect. And so I'm locked into this language. I can play with my language all I want. I can reverse it. I can, you know, stand it on its head. I can find another reversal. And here I am playing with my words, and I can't do a darn thing about those lawns. So I think the impetus for that piece comes, you know, that's what that means, you know, if it means anything.
I've been speaking to Lydia Davis about her collection, Samuel Johnson is Indignant. Samuel Johnson is not the only one who has been indignant, but the moving quality here is that there is the sadness of indignation and the impotence of indignation. I think Samuel Johnson had a sense of the omnipotence of his indignation, that he could affect with his biliousness those around him. But this is almost like an unconditional surrender. All I have are my words, and that's what's so moving about it. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Our engineer today is Chip Borton. We are here in the library of the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with a small audience for my guest, Lydia Davis. Our technical director is Ray Guarna, with technical assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.